Hello, welcome to Your Mind Matters, MPL's first ever mental health awareness podcast, where we discuss mental health and all things related. I am Bassam Habib, the BUL at MPL program manager.
And I am Lana Bolijak with the Education and Literacy Department here at Nashville Public Library.
We have a really special person just with the whole city of Nashville that is with us today in this studio, Jennifer Wong. Thank you for coming and grounding us.
Thank you for having me.
Should we kick it off with an icebreaker, or should we get, let's do the icebreaker.
Yeah, let's get into the icebreaker before we start talking about mindful communication.
Yeah.
So, and we kind of teased this with you earlier, but we wanted to ask you, what is a smell that reminds you of a special place or memory? Or a thing that makes you feel calm or happy or at ease, anything.
Mm. I love this question because it's bringing us back to our senses, which brings us back to our body, which brings us back to this moment. So thank you for that. A smell that's been on my mind recently is the smell of Taiwan, which is where my family is from. Whenever I land at the airport there when I'm going to visit family, I'm like, oh, I'm in Taiwan, even before I look at anything around me. And if I were to break it apart, I guess it's a combination of like cigarette smell and maybe like restaurant steam and dirt, and like not things that you would necessarily traditionally associate with something that's like, oh, nice and beautiful. But I smell that. I'm like, oh, it's like this sense of home. And there are times when I'm in this country and I will smell things like the combination of cigarette smoke and restaurant refuse. And I'm like, oh, it smells like Taiwan.
It's crazy how cigarette smoke has become like a warming the soul scent from, because that's the same for me too. Mm-hmm. Whenever I smell cigarette smoke, I'm like, oh, my grandpa. Like, yeah, it's like. Yeah.
I think of my like musician friends. I was literally on the way to work today and my window's down, and someone in the car next to me, I was smelling what they were smoking. And I want to say it was like I can't remember.
American Spirits.
Thank you. American Spirits.
Oh, yeah.
Because they have
a smell. They do have a distinct smell.
And I feel like that's what every time I go to like an improv jam with like my musician friends, and there's like a break, we always like go outside and just chat because it's super loud inside. And they'll like have their drinks and they'll like pull out their cigarettes. And it's always like an American Spirit box. And it smells like, they just smell like smoke. And not my favorite smell, but the memory is my favorite memory.
So both of you like the smell of
cigarettes. Like the smell of cigarettes.
It's your favorite. It's your favorite smell.
Oh my goodness.
I would say my favorite smell is blood orange.
Mm.
I don't really know what it reminds me of, but it makes me feel, if you walk into my house, it smells like lavender and blood orange.
Mm. That's a nice combination.
Sounds really nice.
That just brings me back to the earth.
For sure.
So.
It's interesting, this topic, I'm going to segue here, this topic of the cigarette smoke, and we were talking about the smell of oil.
Oh,
earlier.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Normally, I think a lot of people would associate judgment with those things, right? Like, ew,
yeah.
Cigarette smoke, ew, the smell of oil. But these things inherently don't have any characteristic of ew or yum, or I mean, I guess I wouldn't want to drink oil. Ew, good or bad, let's say.
Mm.
And all of us, because of our life experiences, associate different things with them. Mm. So it's like, oh, cigarette smell, pleasant, Taiwan, because of my life experience.
Yeah.
And that then leads me into compassion, right? Which is like, you never know where someone is coming from. You could see someone, I don't know why someone would do this, but like inhaling restaurant refuse smell or inhaling cigarette smell. And you could maybe potentially start judging, you know, make some sort of judgment to yourself. But you never know like what's going on for that person.
It's like the story, the story that we're telling about the thing.
Exactly.
Makes it. Is like, it's the same with alcohol, I think. So I always thought that alcohol was like haram in Islam, but it's actually not. It's like drinking the alcohol is what's not good, but you can use the alcohol for other things. It's how you use it that makes it okay or not okay or whatever. So it's like the story that we're telling about the thing, which is really interesting because there's a lot of discussions here at the library about DEI related things and like how we can improve like our DEI stuff. And it seems like a lot of the conversations that we have, and when you get to the bottom of it, it's really just about like understanding and compassion and just being able to like listen to someone's experience instead of coming with like an assumption of what somebody's like.
It's about perspectives.
Yeah, the perspectives. So it's like the stories that we like tell each other are, or the stories that we even tell ourselves are like a huge part of how we even like treat each other on a subconscious level.
Yeah.
Let's get into it.
You talked about a little bit about where you were from and your, you know, the memory of home. So that is a good segue into you just telling us a little bit more about yourself, where you're from, what you do here in Nashville, and we'll get into some other stuff after that. But yeah.
Sure. So I grew up in Los Angeles, really like in this immigrant household that was really focused on success. Right. So my parents working hard to give me and my sisters as many opportunities as possible. So really valued, focused things like good schools and playing piano and all those things. So that eventually led me to a career, skipping a couple of years, in investment banking. So if you're familiar with investment banking, it's like belly of the beast of capitalism. And I find that it's such like a good story of transformation. So I was in the belly of the beast doing investment banking for 8 years. And for six of those years, I was living in London. And then the rest of it was split between Los Angeles and New York. So I was living in these gigantic cosmopolitan cities. And after London, I moved back to Los Angeles and started working in startups. So that's another really fast-paced, hardcore, like the end justifies the means type of space. For the most part, I don't want to generalize all startups.
You got to grind.
Grind. It's a grind. So I was in that startup world, and then this job opportunity arose from a former boss in Nashville. And I was like, oh, do I want to like uproot my whole life in LA, where my family is, to move to Nashville? And that was actually this whole journey, thought process of really kind of soul searching to see, do I want to leave the place where I thought I was going to settle and go to this new place? And if so, why? The job was cool, but it wasn't like enough to move me here. What helped me make the decision was largely my practice. So my mindfulness meditation practice. And that's coming to my background of, at the same time, my career has kind of followed this capitalist track. I started a meditation mindfulness Buddhist track, I guess, when I was in London, because I was feeling really stressed out. A lot of people come to this path because of suffering, and I was no different. My grandfather had just died, and I was like, there's got to be more to life than work and play, essentially. So I started checking out religion, and I started with Buddhism. And I was like, oh, this self-care thing feels nice. And then I started learning the teachings, and it became way more than self-care. It became like, oh, this is like real wisdom that actually I feel like I've known my whole life. I just didn't have words for it. And that was really cool. That was such an amazing feeling because it wasn't like I have to learn this esoteric teaching and believe blind faith in teachings. These things mirrored what I kind of experienced in my own heart and mind when I slowed down and gave myself a chance to really realize them.
Was that Nashville POC Sangha beginnings? Or was that...
No, I wasn't even thinking about it. That was just my own personal practice. Maybe if you say beginnings in terms of Nashville POC Sangha, Jennifer's beginnings as a practitioner.
Yeah.
Okay. Finding any sort of spiritual path or self-care path or whatever you want to call it, mental health path.
Yeah.
That was the beginning of that. And so being on that journey, being on that path, coupled with having some good friends in this, when I was living in LA, back in LA after London, having some good friends who were Black women who were like telling me about their experiences. And then from that, really just diving in and like reading a bunch of books, watching a bunch of documentaries, listening to a bunch of podcasts, having conversations and really listening in conversation rather than speaking. And so I was on this racial equity journey. I was on this mindfulness journey and I was starting to teach meditation. And so when this job opportunity in Nashville came up and I was feeling all settled in LA, I was like, why? Why do I feel settled in LA? Like, how settled do I actually feel? Mm-hmm. Is it an intentional move that I want to stay in LA? And the answer was, no, I don't feel like I need to stay in LA. Maybe I can bring this education that I have in mindfulness and racial equity to somewhere like Nashville And maybe I can learn what it's like to live in a different city that's not this huge cosmopolitan crazy city like London, LA, New York. And I can see what it feels like to be in community there.
Mm. Yeah. Nashville really needs that. So that's awesome. Thank you for coming to Nashville and not staying in LA and choosing the uncomfortable path. You were comfortable in LA. You were like not having much struggles. And then you were like, yeah, I'm just going to leave it all and go to Nashville to take this other position that might be a little scary or whatever. But why do we want to numb ourselves from sitting with pain of discomfort? Like, why is that a thing?
I mean, I feel like it's a pretty natural human tendency to seek comfort and to push away discomfort. I think what we do with that is the key, right? Like, it's so natural to say, ooh, you know, just on the smallest level, like, I've been standing for a long time. I want to sit. It's comfortable. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think what starts to maybe create harm, it's not a good or bad thing, is create harm is if we really are like attaching ourselves to needing that comfort and we're clinging on to it, we're craving that comfort, and we start to ignore other things and lose sight of reality, like what's actually happening right now, because we're tunnel vision focused on that comfort. And you can replace the word comfort with like social media, like these pings of pleasure from social media, pings of pleasure from food, alcohol, shopping, money, you know, whatever you want to call it. And now you might be starting to hear similar words to addiction, right? Like these pings of pleasure. And so I don't think the initial wanting of comfort is unusual. It's so human. It's what do we do with it? And I think a lot of people don't take the time and don't have the training. Like this kind of does take a little bit of effort and knowledge and training to say, okay, I feel that craving for comfort, or the flip side of it, I feel that pushing away that aversion of discomfort. And that's just a thing. That's just a feeling. I don't have to do something about that. I don't have to let that consume me. And that's where the freedom comes in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when it comes to the work that you do at Nashville POC Sangha, am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Sangha?
Yeah. Should I say a little bit about what that means?
Yes, please. I would love to know more about what that means and then also how you kind of incorporate what you do in your daily life.
So Nashville POC Sangha stands for Nashville People of Color Sangha. And Sangha, S-A-N-G-H-A, is a Sanskrit word for spiritual community. Mm. And Sanskrit was the language that was the written language at the time of the Buddha. And so that's all it means, spiritual community. Nashville POC Sangha is a meditation community for people of color. So we have gatherings, virtual and in person, that are they're dedicated spaces for people of color. And, you know, we've gotten questions that say, well, I'm a white ally. Can I join? I want to learn. This, you know, I want to use this as a way to learn. And what we say is we appreciate your allyship. And this is a space just for people of color because the learning journey of a white ally in terms of race and in terms of even like mindfulness meditation can be very different from the learning journey and the healing journey for a person of color. Mm-hmm. And a lot of time for people of color, our suffering comes from racial suffering. Mm-hmm. And so if we're in a space where the intention of the space is to look at our own minds and to heal and to be open and be vulnerable if we're having group conversation or even just with ourselves, right? Like, oh, I saw this in my meditation with my mind. Oh, maybe this is how my mind works. And we bring kindness to that. A lot of times when we're in mixed race spaces, there can be a little bit of either conscious or subconscious, like holding back. Mm-hmm. I don't want to offend that person. And I think that goes for both the white-bodied people as well as the people of color. So it's really just a way to create safety until our society has gotten to a place where we've all healed on the people of color side and educated ourselves enough on the everybody side to say, oh, like, let me learn how to listen skillfully and mindfully. Let me figure out and really embody the sense of separating what intent versus impact means, knowing that they're different. And then how can we have conversation in an authentic way where we're also being really sensitive to each other?
Hmm. So on piggybacking off of that, how do you assist people of color when they come into your practice and they are maybe dealing with things outside of, your, like at work, where they're in a space where they can't be, or maybe there's this kind of like, I have to be this type of Black person.
Yeah.
Because I don't want other people to assume that I am different. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like the code switching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I hear that a lot. You know, what I really try to encourage is like this focus on the internal freedom. So there's internal freedom and there's external freedom. And we say this on our website, you know, we are here for internal liberation as well as external liberation. And so the internal liberation is, how can you work with yourself, give yourself enough compassion? And, you know, these are, there are practices for all of these things. So it's not like, what's wrong with you? You don't have the compassion thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, these are all things that we can learn and help ourselves and help each other with through Sangha, through community. There's a sense of like, can I be my own first responder when something feels threatening or scary or tight, or like I'm acting in a way that I don't like? Mm-hmm. There's a sense of like, can I be my own first responder when something feels threatening or scary or tight, or like I'm acting in a way that I don't like? Mm-hmm. Can your first response to yourself be, I care, whatever it is? Mm-hmm. All right. So can you start to heal yourself and be with yourself for yourself just with this simple phrase of I care? And then can you be aware of when I'm doing the code switching, or has it gotten automatic?
Mm.
Can I be aware of when my body is tensing up because I see that person starting to walk into my office? And then can I tell myself I care because I know there's been a flag that's been raised that my belly or my chest or whatever is getting tight? Then I can apply that I care.
Yeah.
And that's mindfulness.
Yeah.
What was your journey like with that? Like, how did you get to a place where you could apply, like, where you could practice these mindful techniques, and then now you're teaching and applying these, like, mindful techniques? What was that journey like?
I just want to say that I am not, like, the mindful person. I'm not mindful 100% of the day. This is a lifelong plus journey, right?
Yeah.
Like, there are plenty of moments in the day where I'm like, what did I just do? Like totally tuned out. So it's, I think the first thing to say is always really important to apply that self-compassion when you do notice that you've been speaking in a Texan accent or, you know, whatever it is. And as you say, it is difficult, but it's not. This is who we are at our core. It's not like to be authentic to ourselves and to be mindful and conscious, we have to add all these teachings and like do all this stuff. All this stuff is here within us. Mm. What we need to practice is uncovering the stuff that has blocked ourselves from that kind of inherent, some people call it basic goodness, like this inherent awareness.
Mm.
Is it ever healthy to shut that down? Like, is it ever healthy to be like, I don't have time to like listen to myself right now? Or should you always be listening to yourself, like listening to your body?
Yeah, I would say my goal is to 100% of the time be aware, even when I'm not being aware. So if I'm watching a movie and I'm getting totally absorbed into the movie, there's like a small part of me, which I would love to be like, right now I'm getting totally absorbed into the movie. And I actually try to practice this.
Wow. It's like meta. What is that, like metacognition? What is that? Like where you're like aware of your...
Aware of the awareness.
Yeah,
I guess so.
Like an out-of-body experience.
Aware of awareness. Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
What can you start to do to like not just take yourself completely out of that environment that you're in, but start listening?
Yeah. Maybe I'll answer this by telling a little bit more of my story.
Mm. Okay.
Because remember, I was an investment banker. I was stressed out.
I keep immediately forgetting.
I know.
I just will never remember.
I was working 80 to 100 hour weeks. I was in a really stressful relationship.
Mm.
I would say at some points emotionally abusive. I was living separated from nature, separated from my family. I had like no social life. So there was a lot of suffering and dissatisfaction, even though I was like, oh, like I'm getting to live in London, like so fun. deep inside, I knew something was off. And then I started meditating. And so I guess the first, like part A of the answer to your question is like, there's something really simple and powerful and easy and quick about stillness. You could just stop. Actually, a therapist I went to said, recommended that every morning I lie down on the ground for 5 minutes and just lie there, just being in touch with the earth. You literally can just stop your body, put down devices, just take the moment and the intention to be in this moment right now. And it can be as fast as standing still and saying, am I here right now? Am I here right now? Am I here right now? Okay. So that's where it starts. And then you can look into practices like these meditation practices. There's so many resources out there now. But I would say do not underestimate the value of silence and stillness. And a lot of people are afraid of that because they're like, well, I don't want to see what's going to come up in my mind when I'm still with it. And there's that compassion. Like, oh, there's anger. I care. Oh, there's jealousy. I care. Oh, there's anxiety. Every single thing. I care.
Well, while we're on the topic of listening to ourselves, you had mentioned ahead of time that like maybe talking about the art of listening is something that we should bring up. So what is that and how do we break that down for our listeners?
Yeah, so I think there's listening to yourself and there's listening to others. We talked a little bit about listening to ourselves with stillness and also the senses, like that question that you started with, which was great. So you can listen to your senses and what your senses are telling you. You can listen to your body and what your body is telling you. Like if you know that you have an autoimmune disease and you're feeling the pain from the autoimmune disease, that's a message that something is wrong. Or if you're feeling anger, maybe that's a message that something is wrong that needs to be looked at. Listening to other people, there's this phrase that I learned, it's not my phrase, that I love. And I remind myself of this all the time. When you're in conversation with another person and they're speaking, or maybe not even speaking, a really good question you could ask yourself is, can I feel them? Can I feel them? And I think what that helps us, helps prevent, is oftentimes when we're listening to someone, they've started, and 5 seconds in, our brains are already on, how can I respond? What question can I ask to show them I'm listening? How can I nod? Like this concept of active listening, of like always having to do something. What if you could just be a little still and just see if you can actually feel what's going on for that person? So a really good example I have of this, I was thinking about this. Imagine you're starting to date someone, right? And they're starting to tell you, but you're close enough that like you care about them. They're starting to tell you about their ex, like their dating history, right? They're starting to tell you about a situation with an ex where the ex was just like, the relationship was really hard and they were going through a lot. I think a lot of people's natural tendency would be to jump to, oh, I better find out like, what was the ex like? Were they similar to me? How did this person react? Do I see any signs of that now? You know, all the questions that would relate back to me, my agenda, what do I need to find out about this situation now that they're sharing it to prepare myself for this relationship or whatever it might be? Rather than, can I feel this person? Oh, that sounds like a really hard, painful situation. What was that like for you? Or maybe asking more about that to see if they're open to actually, like, I mean, they're talking about it with you. So it could be an opportunity for deepening that relationship right there just by staying with them and their experience rather than bringing it back to you immediately.
It's like taking the stress out of listening.
I'm so glad that you said that it sounds like there's not stress in it, right?
Yeah, it makes listening not stressful.
That's a really great way to think about it. It's also a generosity to that person because you're with them. You're feeling them rather than bringing it back to you and your agenda. And it's a really good question of like, if you have any sort of, and this is not just mindfulness meditation, if you've been to therapy, if you've been doing things to look at yourself, it's really easy to then go out and be like, why aren't you mindful? Why aren't you whatever, like the therapy speak? And that never works, right? Or the other way of doing it is to teach. Let me teach you how to listen. That usually doesn't work either. This is a little bit more of a long-term approach, but modeling is really impactful in this space. Like when you're trying to see if you can feel the other person, usually they can feel it. So I've experienced this in my work. So Nashville POC Sangha is like basically the whole theme is why I feel like I'm on this planet. But for my work right now, I work in climate change. And recently I've been working with like government organizations, and government organizations can be very much like task oriented, not human connected. And I might slow down my pace of speaking in a meeting, or I might message someone in Zoom just really briefly to be like, hey, how are you doing? It's nice to see you. Just like really small things like that. And so you can model that kind of thing. I'm also thinking about my parents and conversations I've had with them, mm-hmm. right? Like getting to the age thing, where it really has not worked to use like therapy, mental health speak.
Yeah.
But a lot of times what I'll do is I'll do for them what I feel like I need for myself. So for example, like this might be something that's pretty common in lots of Asian families, but like when we were growing up, it wasn't a normal thing to compliment each other. My parents every so often will definitely say, oh, I'm so proud of you guys. But it's not like on a daily basis, it was like, oh, you made these friends. Oh, it's because you're such like a kind, sweet person, that type of thing. It would probably, if anything, be more achievement oriented. And so the modeling that sometimes I will try to do will be like, wow, mom, you spent so much time figuring out all these like logistical things for our family dinner or whatever. Thank you. You know, like things like that where I'm like, I would love for my mom specifically to say that to me.
Mm-hmm. And it's a way of relating to people. So then that way they open up a little bit more to you.
Yeah.
That's fantastic advice, because I feel like I struggle a lot with my parents too, like specifically with my dad, because we have very different views. And my like biggest thing is like being heard and like feeling seen. And I have said like multiple times, like, oh, like this is how our conversations make me feel sometimes. But I've never thought of, well, if I just act how I want him to act towards me, maybe he will internalize that and do that for me. Because obviously the way that we're communicating now, it's not getting across. And I mean, that in a lot of ways, how a lot of us do communicate is we're trying to get you to get me. Like, I'm trying to get you to understand me.
Right.
And when you don't get me, I'm upset. And then we have a rift.
Right.
Instead of there just being like, well, there's got to be patience. There's got to be grace. There's got to be understanding. I'm going to treat you the way that I would want you. It does go back to the golden rule, I guess.
Yeah, it's just literally, it's like beautiful advice.
But they may not change too, right? Like just because you're modeling it, they may not pick up on it.
That's real.
I think it's from, I think it's from the pain of feeling uncomfortable, because they don't want to sit with, like if you're telling someone, like if I tell like my mom or my boss or somebody that's like, set in a way about something, if I go up to them and I'm like, this is hurting my feelings, or you're not seeing me, or you're not understanding me or something, I think that might make them so uncomfortable that they don't want to sit with that like discomfort of like being a villain, or like being like somebody that hurts someone's feelings. So they just kind of like, it creates this like, they don't want to be uncomfortable. They don't want to hear it. Mm-hmm. Like they don't want to like sit with it. I guess what I meant was, how can you get them to sit in that pain?
Is that even a good thing to want? Like, I don't know if we should want to push people to sit in a pain.
So I think with this type of thing, you're talking about, you don't want them to sit in the pain just for the sake of sitting in pain, right? You want them to sit in pain so that they can change. I would say there are some relationships, like time is so important. There are some relationships that do not need to be repaired right now, that would not be helpful to be repaired right now. And there are some relationships where you might want to repair them. And I think a really good question for any sort of communication, whether it's reparations or trying to build something, is to ask yourself why. Like, what is my intention with this thing I want to say? What is my intention with wanting to reconcile? So that's a really good first step for mindful communication, is checking in with yourself. What is my intention for this? So, for example, with my parents, right, I could say, I need you to understand me. I need to explain things to you. I need to tell you about all these things. And I need you to reflect that back to me, to show me that you know that, understand. if I ask myself why, like, what is my intention with this? If my overall intention is to bring us closer, then maybe that whole path, that route that I just sketched out, is not actually going to achieve the goal of bringing us closer, because maybe mm-hmm. their minds don't work that way. Maybe for them to get closer, they need some grace, or they need to just go share a meal together, or they need something else. So this brings me to this topic of nonviolent communication. Have either mm-hmm. of you heard of this? You've heard of it?
Yeah, briefly, yeah.
So it
from you, actually.
Oh, okay.
You introduced right. me to it.
So this is not something that I came up with. It's something that come up with by someone named Dr. Marshall Rosenberg. And there have been other teachers in kind of Buddhist meditation traditions that have adapted this to their teachings as well. But I really like the premise of nonviolent communication because it focuses on needs rather than blame. So rather than saying, like, you did this wrong because you weren't listening to me, it focuses on me and saying, hey, you know, when you did this, when you were on your phone while we were having dinner, for example, it made me feel like I wasn't being heard. Okay, so it made me feel that way. And you could add subtitles like, made me feel that way because when, like, in my childhood, this happened where that happened and it made me feel not heard, right? Like, for a number of reasons, this is why it made me feel, not because the thing you did was inherently bad. That's my point. It's not a blaming thing. When you did that, it made me feel this. What I need is to feel heard when we're together. Would you be willing to maybe, you know, put your phone down when we're having a meal together? And so that request actually, and I might have, it's been a long time since I've read that book, so I might have like butchered the sequencing, but it focuses around my own need, not as a blaming thing for everybody you're doing wrong, but my own need is because of who I am and the particulars of my life and who I am, this is my need. And it ends with a request. And so what you're saying with like the person that doesn't understand you is maybe they don't need to sit in their pain. Maybe they can hear you. And if you just give them a request, they can be like, oh, okay, I can do that. Mm-hmm. And maybe eventually yeah. they get to the point where like, oh, okay, that made him feel not heard. Maybe I need to look at why I was engaging in that behavior. But that, I think that's somebody else's personal journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm carrying too many journeys. I just need to only carry my own journey.
It's a lot of heaviness to carry other people's journeys.
Yeah, it's just, like the relationships are like so important to me. Maybe a little too important, I guess. So I always like have this like overthinking. Yeah, sometimes it's like just chill and focus on what you need and tell mm-hmm. them what you need.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be amazing if we all could just say what we mean?
Yeah. Oh my
goodness.
And
we don't have to analyze each other and be like, well, they said that, therefore they must mean that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, I mean, that's another one of our questions, too, is how does our tone and our inflection, how can we use those things to kind of, like, communicate more effectively? Like, you've talked about using nonviolent language and, you know, taking the blaming kind of words that might make people feel attacked and turning it around and making it, okay, this is how this makes me feel. Mm-hmm. In what ways, if that doesn't go in the way that we intend? And
yeah. Well, I also want to add that it's okay. I feel like the anger is okay. And one criticism that has been brought to nonviolent communication is specifically with people of color, where it could be seen as, like, for example, somebody says a racist thing, and I have to be like, well, because of my needs, I would really like for you to not call me that word. Would you mind not calling me? You know, no.
No, that's not
going
to work.
Yeah, exactly.
It never works.
So that is a criticism of that, which I totally get. I think the way that we can adapt that and then also address what you're talking about is it comes back to mindfulness and listening to ourselves. What is my intention here? Hmm. If I'm being angry, am I aware that I'm being angry or is it out of control? Because sometimes I will raise my voice and be angry because I want to communicate that something is not okay. There's an energy there. And so I don't know if you all noticed, like when I said that thing about race and nonviolent communication, there was more energy in my voice.
Yeah.
Right. And because I wanted to make it clear to anyone who's listening that's not an okay thing to do, right? So we can use our anger if we can be mindful of our anger or whatever emotions are coming up for us. So when we're thinking about tone and nonverbal communication, I just think of it as being present in my body and listening to myself and my intention. And those other cues follow.
It's that simple.
So anger
try
is
it.
Okay.
Let me know.
Anger is okay.
I will try.
Let me know. Yeah.
Because I've been like, there are a couple of things going on in my life that I won't get into, but I just like have struggled with, like, I'm really big on honesty and like being transparent, but I have learned lately I'm not the best communicator. I'm not as good of a communicator as I thought I was. And so there are moments where I say things and it has a trickle effect in my relationships. And then I'm like, okay, now I have to repair this, but I don't really know. One, I don't really know where I went wrong. And two, I don't really know how to repair. Maybe I've said something that I can't take back because I was upset or because I wanted to be heard so badly that I said this mean thing. And now this mean thing is like living in the relationship. How do I now assuage this issue? So I will, I think that's a really great thing to think about is still just reminding yourself like, okay, what's my intention? How am I feeling? And then letting that lead everything else.
Yeah.
Makes total sense.
And then even with that, like, I really wasn't joking when I said, wouldn't it be great if we could just say what we mean? Mm-hmm. Like, wouldn't it be great if you could say to that person, oh, shoot, I really stuck my foot in my mouth just now, but here's what I meant to say. Can we start over? You know, just like really be honest with what you're feeling and saying before it piles up to the point where you're so weighed down with resentment and in your mind, they're so mad at you and it becomes this big, heavy thing.
Yeah.
It can just like nip it in the bud and just be like, oh, that came out not the way I wanted it to.
I feel like that's a two-way thing, though. Like, they also have to be on that wavelength or that frequency of like, all right, we're going to like say exactly what we mean. So then we create the relationship lives in an environment where that is like fostered.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm in a relationship with somebody and they don't, like, they're not doing that, I find that it's like way harder for me to do that. I don't know how to like match that. Where I'm like, oh, man. And then it brings up these, like, feelings of inauthenticity where I'm like, I'm not really telling you how I feel. But I'm like, it's not your fault that I'm not telling you how I feel. But the environment that we created for our relationship is, like, making it to where we can't, like, say how we feel to each other. Do you think that it's kind of like that? Or is it, like, more about you can be in any environment and say how you feel?
No, I think you're right. I think nothing is ever just a one-sided thing, right? Everything comes from causes and conditions, the environment that you're in, the people that you're with, always. But I will say that somebody has to take the first step.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I had a friend who, like, and this is not that long ago, and she was the one who did that for me, right? Like, I teach mindfulness. And we were having a conversation about something, and it was something that was starting to get a little sticky. And I think I had said, well, let's just like park, we were going to work on a project together. I was like, okay, let's just park that project because I don't want it to affect our relationship. And she kept not being satisfied with that. Like, we were just going around in circles. And finally she said, you don't want it to affect our relationship because you care about our relationship, right? Because you value our relationship. And I was like, yeah, duh, in my mind, right? But she actually needed to hear that.
Hmm.
And so her saying that to me was nonviolent communication. She doesn't practice nonviolent communication at all. She just knew what she needed. And she was willing to tell me, which was amazing, which was probably uncomfortable for her. But she told me what she needed. I was a little taken back because I was like, what? I'm this like mindfulness person and I'm like not providing this person what they need. But it was such a good lesson for me because I was like, number one, this is something I've been working on most of my adult life, which is sharing more of like the positivity, like I was saying with how I grew up and not doing that, like sharing more of what I value about people. So that was like, oh, this is a good reminder to help me on this learning path of mine. And also that, you know, I teach this stuff, but I don't know everything. This is still a journey because every human is different. So I'm never going to be able to like know how to communicate well with everyone.
Mm-hmm. We are like a 250,000-year-old species or something like that. Or like, 12, I don't know, 12,000?
Millions.
Yeah. I don't know how old
we're this pretty old.
Life is, however old life is, but we're now at a place where we're like talking about how do we even communicate with each other?
Yeah.
Like, we like lost that or something happened where we are like not knowing how to communicate with each other.
Yeah.
Like, what happened? Where did we go wrong?
I think about it as we've become disconnected from ourselves. And because we as humans are part of this earth, we've become disconnected from the earth. That's why we're extractive of each other and of the earth. Also, that in recent years, our technology has advanced so much faster than our human development has advanced. So our human development has not caught up with our technology. And I think this comes back to social media. Mm. And I think there's studies about how kids, like, they're developmentally being really challenged right now because something about how their brains they're meeting all these stimuli from social media so much earlier than their brains are ready for, that they don't know how to deal with it. And therefore we have depression and like so many mental health problems with children, children.
The fact that like a 5-year-old is like has an iPad and can just without an mm-hmm. application or anything can get on the internet and start talking with people and like getting in fights with people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, it's crazy. I wonder if in like 40 years, like, we're going to be like, they're going to look back on this time and they're going to be like, damn, that was like so crazy. Everybody had a phone and they were just on the internet all the time. Like, they didn't have, they were literally like doing it every single day, most of the day. And now we know, you know, you have to like sign up to, I don't know, you have to be like vetted or something.
You think it's
going to
go in that direction?
Like, I think it's going to go in the direction of like, it's kind of like smoking, like how like back in the day they were like, oh, this is like a healthy thing for relaxation.
Yeah.
And now they're like, this is not okay at all. So like now we're like just on, we're like, yeah, email me, text me in like 40 years. We're going to be like, oh yeah, that's why we're like, society has regressed so much now.
I mean, it's interesting because we're talking about mindfulness, but nothing about social media requires you to be mindful of anything. It's almost kind of like it is a tool that is quite literally mindless. I can just scroll.
Mm. It doesn't have to be, though.
You don't think so?
So actually, when I go on retreat, we give up our phones.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a whole practice of bringing the phones back. And the social media, the phone itself is not the problem.
Right.
It's our relationship to it.
Oh.
Mm.
So we could, you know, like, I have nieces and nephews in LA. Like, I could use this phone to look at pictures of them, and it enhances my life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could say, okay, I'm done. That's enough.
I don't have the discipline of being like, okay, like, no phone today, because I have to do emails. And then I'll like delete the apps off my phone, and then I'll be like, oh, I just need to get it back on like Instagram to see like what's happening. It's kind of this like addiction, totally, mm-hmm. of like wanting to see like
what people are
what
doing,
is
what's
going on.
But I've noticed I deleted my social media recently, except for Twitter, sorry. But I've noticed that even when I get the itch to like know what people are doing without the app on my phone, it really helps. Like, I've cheated a little. Like, I'll pull it up on like Safari,
mm-hmm.
and I'll literally just kind of scroll for like a minute. And the fact that it's like not formatted the way that I'm used to makes me go, okay, like, I don't care anymore. And I put my phone back down.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's my way of kind of like regulating. I wasn't in a great headspace when I was on it all the time. I was just kind of mindless. And like, there's little things that you can do. Like you said, it's about I can use this device for this purpose, and I can also choose to put it away.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, I can answer emails between the hours of 9 and 5. And then at 5 o'clock, I am no longer answering emails. And that's like my boundary so that this thing doesn't take over my life. Right.
Yeah. I feel like but it's like what you're saying, like, if you zoom out in the bigger picture, how we've evolved with the technology, we like went to the moon and saw like the earth from space, and it was like we are like looking back at ourselves, And then from there, now we're like on social media. And that was like, what, like a 50, 60 year period, which is like nothing. But that amount of self went from the earth to like zoomed in, like every single individual is now like able to see their own reflection so fast. So it's way harder for us to like be like, okay, yeah, I'm gonna like stop like doing this, right. I guess. You know what I mean? Like we need like retreats. We need to like put the phone in a box and lock it away from us, or like to like stop it, which is really weird and interesting to think about.
I think it's definitely not connecting us as much as we probably are hoping that it does. I don't feel connected to people through social media. It's almost kind of like, it's like a facade of connection. Because the people that like, I mean, I don't know, I have a lot of friends on like Facebook that I went to high school with, but like, I don't know them. Like, we are not close anymore. I don't know what they're doing. If I get on Facebook and they post a picture that they just got married or had a new baby or whatever, it's, oh, congrats. And it's a like or a heart or whatever. But in reality, do I know anything about them now, the person that they are now versus the person I knew in high school? No. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not connected in any real way. Mm-hmm. I just like knowing you're having big milestones, or when you're having a breakdown and you go on Facebook and you, you know, type out whatever feelings you're having. I know that you're feeling a certain way. I don't really know. And so I think that this illusion of connectedness through, you know, seeing what people are doing or where people are going, but not really knowing, is the thing that makes us feel connected, but really we aren't at all.
Mm. That time when you said things were not feeling good with social media, so you deleted it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember if during that time you felt more lonely?
Yeah.
Like when you were so on it, when you were...
I mean, it's not that I felt more lonely. The loneliness was there.
Yeah.
I think that seeing people that were, you know, sharing on their story or posting or whatever, and I think it was like a double-edged sword. It was the comparison.
Yeah.
And it was also the kind of like longing, like people that I like kind of wish that we were closer, or I wish we could talk, or like I want us to do whatever, but I don't know if there's like a, like we haven't talked in so long, or we're having an issue or whatever. I can see what you're doing. I can peek into your life and like see what's going on. But the fact that like what's going on does not include me makes me feel a little bit like, oh, I'm taking this personally, even though I don't really need to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
And so, and then I told you before, I'm a musician, so I see like there's so much music stuff happening on social media, and there's so many people that are like dropping songs, and they're like, oh, my song got this many streams, or I'm going on tour with this person, and you're like, oh, that's great. I'm not doing enough. Let me do the things that everyone else is doing. Yeah, and so I was like, I was already dealing with some other really hard stuff, and then that on top of it, I was like, this is not good, and I need to do something about one of them that's more immediate. And so that was the thing that I could do, was just delete it off my phone for now and go touch grass.
Yeah, I can't feel somebody through, I don't even like phone calls.
Yeah,
I can't even, I would much rather like, it's like, we are in the same room, like talking with each other. So yeah, you can't really feel somebody on like a social media app. I recently got Hinge and then I deleted it after like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this is psychotic. This is next level. Like,
dating apps are the worst.
Dating apps are like hell. Dying and going to hell is like, hey, you're now on Hinge. And then you're like just thumbing through the whole city. Like, you're like, oh, yeah, interesting, not interesting. It's like hot or not, basically, is like what you're doing.
Right.
It's like so insane. But
not if you do it that way.
I go through these like waves and cycles of deleting Instagram and Facebook and all the social media and like everything off my phone. I would just go outside and like I have like a garden. So I just started like waking up and immediately getting out of bed because I never did that. Mm. Like for my whole life, I would just wake up and then just stay in bed for like an hour and a half and just like not get out of bed. And so now I'm like trying to like wake up, go outside and then talk to my kale or talk to the birds. Which brings me to another question. Do you think, I feel like we're reaching this level with the earth and life just in general. We are like totally destroying the world. And some people are like doing the savior like thing where they're like, we have to like, you know, reduce carbon emissions. We have to like do all these like proactive things. And then there's the people that are doing like the gaslighting and the denial. And they're like, no, that's not even happening. Like the world can take care of itself or whatever. But how can we communicate with the earth? Like, what can we do to like listen more, I guess, to just our immediate like environment? If I want to do something that can actually be like climate justice, or if I want to do something that could like be helpful for the environment.
So I think the mindset for me is really this mindset of being a part of the earth. And then the word reciprocity also comes to mind.
Yeah.
And not just like, let's just see what we can take from it and use it as a natural resource, right? Quote unquote, natural resource, but just something that we're a part of, where as humans, we have a responsibility to the earth. And also we know from science that the earth being in nature, as both of you have said, you've experienced in your lives, is healing for us, right? There's all these practices, forest bathing, you know, like I love to go hiking and spend outside. It's so healing to be outside.
Yeah. I guess there's like a bunch of like scientific studies that show that like when you're getting vitamin D from the sun, it like affects your entire, not only just like your emotional, but like it literally is so good for your physical body. And I dream of Alaska a lot because I went to Alaska last year. And I don't know, I have like a lot of my friends probably were like, oh, that sounds like a boring trip. But like, it was just like, there's just trees and like, it was quiet. And like, I saw like a whale and that was cool. Like it was, the air was fresh. And like, I spent most of the time, oh, we were on a boat, but like, I've spent a lot of the time, like every time we would dock, I was like, I just want to go hike. And like, I hiked this like short trail in this small town called Sitka, Alaska. It was great. I just had my phone in my pocket and I just was like, the trees are huge. Mm. I can't see the sky. It's raining, but like the trees are canopying me. And I just was like walking and I was like, oh my God, this is just lovely.
I love that you use the word freeing, that it was a freeing experience. And what I'm also hearing is like love, like this heart opening experience.
Yeah. But I've been like the last couple of weeks, I've just been like, oh, I miss Alaska. I want to go back to Alaska. Take me to Alaska. No,
maybe I can wrap us up by kind of addressing that original question about social media. And I think this also ties to what you're saying, Lana. For me, being on social media reinforces this addiction I feel like a lot of us have to doing things constantly. Mm. So like I've been in so many conversations with people who, of course, everyone has their phones out. And if the topic of conversation, we're in a group, the topic of conversation is not relevant to that one person, they just whip out their phones and start Instagramming or whatever. Rather than just being in the conversation and like being curious, okay, this is not relevant to me now, but it's still maybe interesting. And I think it's the same thing with the shopping mentality on the dating apps, where it's like this constant do. Like I have to swipe. I have to look at what's on Instagram. And I feel like when we train our minds to do that, then it really hampers our ability to connect and to feel the other person when we're in conversation, interaction with them. So I think the social media, like the way that people are using social media just reinforces this constant doing. Mm-hmm. And what I hear you saying about being in nature is that you weren't so focused on the doing. Like everyone would have said it's a boring trip. You were being, right? Like you were being in nature. You were being a part of nature. And this reminds me of this phrase that I love that I say all the time, which is, we are human beings, not human doings.
Oh. Yes. Yeah, I love that. Damn. I need to get that tatted on my body.
Should I have to keep that as a mantra? I'm a human being, not a human doing. this has been a robust and hearty conversation. Thank you so much, Jennifer, for coming.
You're welcome.
And for engaging with us and for leading us in a mindful meditation and all of the great things. I feel like I've just gotten so much good things that I needed to hear today.
Aww.
It's very on time. Thank you guys all for listening. And remember,
your mind matters.